sacrifice zone for the rest of the world, and it's time to make those changes. 80% of all fossil fuels need to stay in the ground. That means they need to stay in the Gulf of Mexico. We will no longer be tied to this archaic system, and we're going to make the changes that we need to do in each and every community across the Gulf of Mexico.
People need to know the story of Nat Turner. We do not know the story of Nat Turner in this country. We know about Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, etc. We rarely hear about a black freedom fighter. And a film was made. Nate was paid. He got almost $20 million, so we will not be not supporting his pocket by not going to see the film. So what's important is that people know who Nat Turner was.
Everybody in here has a human right, just for the sheer fact that they can breathe air, that you are a human being. And it is an onus, it is incumbent upon this world to treat African people in that way.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam. Well, today, as Black August draws to a close, activists continue to mark the month by organizing through education and other acts of resistance. The Nat Turner Rebellion, which happened during this week 185 years ago, is in the news. And we have a distinguished panel in the second half to talk about the controversy surrounding the upcoming release of Nate Parker's film, The Birth of a Nation, which is about Nat Turner. This month also marked the second anniversary of the murder of Michael Brown, and the link that developed between protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, and the Palestinian people under attack by the Israeli military in Gaza. We'll get an update on the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, including the fact that Mayor Muriel Bowser and Maryland Governor Larry Hogan have signed on to a list of governors opposing the BDS movement. The BDS movement targets Israel and institutions complicit in its oppressive policies toward Palestinians until it complies with international law and ensures freedom, justice, and equality for Palestinians. All of that is coming up, but first our headlines. In Black Lives Matter news this week, a black man in Indianapolis was shot by police at his own home after calling them to report an attempted carjacking. In Houston, chapters of both the Black Lives Matter movement and the NAACP put aside differences and held a joint press conference to denounce the gathering of armed white supremacists who rallied Sunday outside the Houston NAACP offices. Here in D.C., the National Conference of Black Lawyers was a primary convener of the August 20th town hall meeting against police murders and mass incarceration at Gethsemane Baptist Church in Northwest D.C. The outcome of the meeting was to develop and implement a plan in the coming months to hold elected officials and the judicial system accountable for extrajudicial killings, the system of mass incarceration, and the continued imprisonment of black political prisoners such as Mumia Abu-Jamal. Baltimore-based attorney Stephanie Franklin connected these issues to international human rights.
Everybody in here has a human right, just for the sheer fact that they can breathe air, that you are a human being. And it is an onus, it is incumbent upon this world to treat African people in that way. If you look systematically all over the world, it is us as African people who are at the bottom of everything. We top every social, economic, political, and cultural issue in this world.
That's right.
Period. And for black people to fight for black people and say black lives matter, they do matter. It is up to us to make sure that they count and that they matter.
Protests of the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline came to Washington, D.C. this week with a rally outside the U.S. District Court in Northwest D.C. Protesters say that the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline would run from western North Dakota to Illinois, carrying hundreds of thousands of barrels of crude oil, disturbing sacred burial grounds, and endangering water supplies at the Standing Rock Reservation and neighboring communities. Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Chairman Dave Archambault II addressed a large crowd outside the courthouse on Wednesday.
I'm really proud and honored that all of you showed up. It means so much, and it means that with prayer, we're strong. Yeah. We're a strong
The protesters also received a boost with celebrities, including actress Susan Sarandon, who spoke to RT outside the courthouse.
What's happening here, if you look at it, just points out what a hypocrite Obama and all the people that profess to be about the earth, the climate, you know, how hypocritical it is, because you can't support fracking, you can't support this. I mean, this is, I think, stands a very good chance to be a major, major teaching tool for so many people, because these things only go to places where they think there aren't, no one has a voice. That's why you have the poisoning in Flint. We have to understand, especially with water, how connected the Missouri River is with other communities, not just their reservation. We have to make those connections. We need to awaken and educate people about what's going to affect their lives and their kids' lives and their water supply and the climate.
After protesters gathered at the D.C. courthouse, District Judge James E. Borsberg said he will render his decision on the case next month. The lawsuit by the Sioux people says that the Army Corps of Engineers failed to comply with environmental and historic preservation laws. Environmental justice protesters also took their case to the federal government in Louisiana, where there were several actions this week, including a rally, arrests, and a call-in campaign to oppose the continued use of the Gulf of Mexico as a sacrifice zone for oil and gas drilling. Sherry Foytlin of Another Gulf is Possible spoke from North Baton Rouge, where she tied together the issues of record flooding in the area to climate change and continued burning of fossil fuels.
This is Sherry Foytlin, standing out here in North Baton Rouge, Louisiana right now. We have about 15 people here that came from Another Gulf to do some loving action and help this lady to be able to gut out her home. She had, looks like, 3 to 4 feet of water inside her home, and a car actually came in and rammed into the front part of her house. So there's a lot of work. She's a cancer patient. FEMA has put her up for 30 days in a hotel. It's going to take far more than 30 days to get this done, especially at the rate that we're going. We need a lot of people, support church groups, to come down and help people pull this stuff out of their houses. Mold's already setting in, you know. Also, I want to say, man, just mad respect to the people that just got arrested in the BOEM offices in New Orleans. Thank you so much for standing up and saying, like, no new leases in the Gulf of Mexico. We know that this was an act of violence upon our communities, just like anything else. These people in North Baton Rouge, just went through a month and a half ago. We had issues of police brutality and protests here, you know, and a lot of people were wrongly arrested and are consistently over-policed, and now they're using the storm as a reason to continue that. So this stuff is all woven together, and that's what we've been trying to say with Another Gulf, trying to build a just transition means far more than just energy. We're going to have to look at all of the intersectionalities of just transition and really just dig in and build a better world for ourselves. Also, I wanted to say much love and solidarity to the people in North Dakota at Standing Rock. We're with you. We will get there as soon as we can. We got a little work to do, but we're standing right beside you in spirit and strength.
Despite the week of action, including calls to the White House, the lease auction did proceed on Wednesday, but attracted a record low number of bids. Only three companies bid on 24 of more than 4,000 tracts. Industry experts blamed low oil prices for the low number of bids. And finally, in culture and media, the controversy is still simmering over the release of the eagerly anticipated biopic on Nat Turner, Birth of a Nation, after reports that writer, director, and lead actor Nate Parker was charged and acquitted of rape charges while he was a student at Penn State 17 years ago. We'll have a roundtable about the controversy coming up in the second half of today's show with novelist and filmmaker Bridget M. Davis, writer and educator Kenny Carroll, and writer L.D. Crittenden. Also in culture and media, look out for more references to the so-called alt-right, short for, I assume, alternative right. Over the last few months, the so-called alt-right has become one of the most prominent factions in the conservative media. The movement's leading outlet is Breitbart News, whose chairman, Stephen Bannon, has just become the CEO of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Oliver Willis of Media Matters writes that In many ways, the alt-right is a rebranding of classic white nationalism for the 21st century. As BuzzFeed described the movement, in short, it's white supremacy perfectly tailored for our times, 4chan-esque racist rhetoric combined with a tinge of Silicon Valley-flavored philosophizing, all riding on the coattails of the Trump boom. Willis writes that the alt-right opposes diversity and immigration, arguing that those policies are a form of white genocide. It embraces racism, sexism, and anti-Muslim bigotry and anti-Semitism and sees its goal as usurping the traditional conservative movement, which it views as feckless and weak, in favor of a brand of nationalism. Media Matters also posts that, according to the most recently available data, African American women on average are paid only 60% of what white men are paid in a year, meaning that they would have to work almost 9 additional months to catch up. August 23rd is an annual day of action, Black Women's Equal Pay Day, focused on that issue, and numerous media outlets noted the event this week by highlighting the plight of African American women in the workforce. Around town, the R&B-only dance party is tonight at the Howard Theater, and South Side With You, a movie about Barack and Michelle Obama's first date, opens in theaters. And those are headlines and happenings when we come back. Did you know that Governor Larry Hogan and Mayor Muriel Bowser signed a petition opposing the boycott divestment sanctions movement? Stay with us.
Ain't no place for living down here on the ground, watching sparrows fly. I watch the birds as they make their way. They're flying kind. And I wish it were me. Down here on the ground, wanting something better. Down here on the ground, wanting something more.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Rivera. Well, continuing with our last show for Black August, since the murder of Mike Brown 2 years ago and the uprising in Ferguson, Missouri, there has been a link between the Movement for Black Lives and the Palestinian people who tweeted Ferguson protesters how to survive the American-made tear gas being used against them, because they were used to that same tear gas being used against them. Since then, the Movement for Black Lives issued its first historic platform, and it drew fire from the pro-Israel lobby for its denunciation of Israel as an apartheid state and charged genocide against the Palestinian people. But the progressive organization Jewish Voice for Peace endorsed the platform and has continued to endorse and actively work for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which targets Israel and institutions complicit in its oppressive policies toward Palestinians until it complies with international law and ensures freedom, justice, and equality for Palestinians. Here this morning to give us an update is Benjamin Douglas, an activist with DMV, DC chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. Welcome back, Benjamin. Well, when we last spoke, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo had just signed an executive order barring agencies from that state from doing business with any organization endorsing the BDS movement. Since then, I see that leaders here in the DMV, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan and D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser have also signed a petition pledging opposition to the BDS movement. What's your reaction to this, to them signing?
Well, first of all, I guess the clear distinction to be made is between measures that have teeth, like the executive order in New York, or that purport to have teeth, they're actually unconstitutional. So if they try and bite, I think they'll be bit back. But things that actually call for taking money away from entities or losing contracts or things like that versus purely symbolic declarations, what Mayor Bowser and Governor Hogan signed on to is a statement being pushed by the American Jewish Committee called Governors Against BDS, and it is a symbolic thing. It doesn't claim to penalize anyone or try to impact your freedom to boycott. Of course, emphasize to anyone out there, you do have the freedom to boycott according to the Constitution. So all these things that try and take it away, they're also illegal. But this is not trying to do that. This is on the symbolic plane still. As more D.C. and Maryland residents mobilize, we're confident that we'll keep it on the symbolic level and even push back there so that they're not condemning people who use their free speech to speak out for human rights.
So I should add here that On the Ground did invite both the office of Mayor Muriel Bowser and the office of Governor Larry Hogan for comment, but received no response. But I want to ask you, Benjamin, who's behind the petition drive and what kind of impact could it have, if any?
Well, there are a lot of organizations fighting against BDS, a lot of what we would call the pro-Israel lobby here in the United States. Sheldon Adelson had a huge initiative against BDS on campus. The American Jewish Committee is a very, very mainstream and powerful organization in the Jewish establishment, and it's pushing this. ALEC has signed on, a lot of elements of the traditional right, Christian Zionist organization. So there's a lot of support. There's also some campaign coming from the Israeli government for global projects, lawfare to try and intimidate people out of engaging in their free speech and their right to boycott. All of these things are pushing it. This specific statement was pushed by the American Jewish Committee.
Okay, and I think that's the website that I actually saw the petition on. So just this week, I think I saw that Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York actually also came out against BDS. And when I think about big figures like that in the Democratic Party, it makes me think that Hillary Clinton's tirade against BDS before AIPAC earlier this year is causing these mainstream Democrats to kind of fall in line, or is that particularly in New York?
I think it would be both. It would be most pronounced in areas where pro-Israel lobbying has been strongest, which is this area in New York, L.A., but it's also nationwide. And I think that they're freaking out. So pro-Israel forces and the Israeli state are used to having really both sides of the debate, a sort of right-wing Zionist and a moderate Zionist debating what's best for Palestinians is standard fare in the liberal press in the United States for a long time. And that's even too far left for most of what the Democratic Party has stood for, let alone the Republican Party for the past few decades. So they're worried as people go to alternate channels. And a lot of, you know, you talked about the Movement for Black Lives platform. A lot of that is new organizing, moving into new spaces, organizing in civil society, getting stronger in civil society, where the same sorts of tit-for-tat bargains do not hold. There's always been a tension between more progressive leadership, particularly more progressive leadership in the black community, and a lot of the pro-Israel establishment because of seeing third world solidarity, seeing racism abroad as akin to racism here and as unjust as well. But as long as it's working within the establishment channels, it doesn't have that much teeth and it doesn't have that much effect. Once it gets outside of that, that's when you see the sort of panicked force. And that's when you see people turning to these elected officials to try and shut down civil society and free speech.
Yeah, because as these anti-statements come out and people like de Blasio come out and denounce the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, it seems to overshadow all the victories that the movement has had. And I saw, I think, on the website of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, kind of a listing of victories, which was actually pretty impressive. And a lot of it centered at universities where students and faculty and administrators have either passed resolutions or done things with perhaps more teeth to support the Palestinian people. Do you think that the emphasis on higher education is what's freaked them out the most?
Possibly so. And I want to note, on Wednesday, or I think it was Wednesday, the NLRB ruled in favor of graduate student organizing. And those have been the unions, usually under the United Auto Workers, which is a peculiar fact of U.S. labor. But they've been the ones most receptive to BDS. And as that organizing expands, you're going to see more teeth in a lot of these. Yes, that's what that is where our biggest victories in this country have been, or our clearest, most favorable terrain for BDS. And I think a lot of that is because when you're in an educated environment, when you're in an environment where academic texts are circulating, the pretenses and the superficiality that prevail in the mainstream media just cannot win out.
Okay, so where else is BDS focusing? I know the last time we spoke, you talked about here locally just several victories in terms of beating back resolutions or actions that legislators were trying to take, but I don't know if you want to give an update on that and just maybe nationally what BDS is focusing on now.
Well, there are a number of campaigns going. The one that I like at present, or the one that's energized, I think, a lot of people in this area the most at present, is the Stolen Homes Coalition against Airbnb. And it's allowing racially segregated, legally segregated settlements in the West Bank. And this is not just de facto segregation. This land is designated for the use of the Jewish people. Israeli settlers live on this land, often confiscated or taken from Palestinians. And they've got two different systems of law governing the Israeli Jews in the settlements and the Palestinians who live nearby. Airbnb is letting people put these properties up for short-term rental on their website. Airbnb is a company that's practicing racism here. I do not use the site I have before. And they said, you know, if you want people to trust you, put your picture up. And I kind of said, wait, what? Why would I show my picture to a hotel? Why would I show my picture here? And statistically, that's been shown to be racist here. But it's racist as well in the West Bank. And so a group of people have formed an organization called the Stolen Homes Coalition to boycott Airbnb, to target Fidelity Investments, to get them to pull their money out. That's energizing. Lots of other people are focusing on issues about cooperation between Israeli police and United States police. That's a very, very prevalent practice, very, very deep-seated thing. I think one officer called Israel the Harvard of anti-terrorism. Well, the people who get educated at the Harvard are going to be practicing very repressive policing. And so there's a common struggle there, and that's a great BDS target. Other people are talking about Hewlett-Packard. Unfortunately, there's a bit of a divide between their consumer division and the part that does most of the contracting with the Israeli government. But that's a target as well. And our eyes are open for all manner of other things.
Okay, so if folks are listening and they want to get involved with our local chapter, how do they get in touch with you?
Well, you can email me at BenjaminEvanDouglas@gmail.com. No hate mail, please, if any adverse parties
haters,
are listening.
Right.
You can also go to JewishVoiceForPeace.org, or you can search for Jewish Voice for Peace DC Metro on Facebook.
Right.
And get in touch with us through that. info@jvp.org.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely continue to follow up and get the word out about the BDS movement, which I think it must be having an impact. And because if all these people feel compelled to come out against it, they must have someone to fight against, right? I've been speaking with Benjamin Douglas, an activist with the DMV, DC chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. Thank you, Benjamin.
Thank you, Esther.
Well, it's the fourth Friday, the day for arts and activism here on the ground. Up next, the film controversy that seems to be tearing apart the Black community. Stay with us. back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, the controversy is still simmering over the eagerly anticipated and soon-to-be-released biopic on Nat Turner, Birth of a Nation, after reports that writer, director, and lead actor Nate Parker was charged and acquitted of rape charges while he was a student at Penn State, and then allegedly engaged in harassment of the alleged victim who committed suicide 4 years ago. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the controversy is tearing apart at least parts of the black community. On my own social media thread, I see author John Jeter cursing in response to a comment made by our honored elder Harry Belafonte, who is standing by Nate Parker. That's just one example. But with me to discuss this film and Nate Parker are three distinguished guests. Bridget M. Davis, author of Into the Go Slow, selected as a 2014 best book by Salon and the San Francisco Chronicle. Davis is a professor at Baruch College, CUNY, where she directs the Harmon Writer-in-Residence program. Davis is also a filmmaker. Her award-winning film Naked Act screened at dozens of festivals in the U.S., Europe, South America, and Africa before having its theatrical and Netflix release. Indiana University's Black Film Center recently honored Davis on the 20th anniversary of the film's production. She joins us via Skype from New York City. Good morning, Bridget.
Good morning, Esther. Good morning.
Kenneth Carroll is a poet, writer, and educator, and I'd say favorite son of D.C. He is former director of D.C. Writers' Corps and past president of the African American Writers Guild. He was recognized by the President's Commission on the Arts and Humanities for Writers' Corps use of youth poetry slams to promote literacy. He joins us from here in D.C. Good morning, Kenny.
Good morning, Esther.
And Latrell Crittenden is assistant professor of communication at Robert Morris University and a board member of the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation. He studies and writes on issues related to diversity and inclusion with the media industry and community journalism. Good morning, Latrell.
Good morning.
Okay, welcome everyone to the show. Well, I'm going to start with you, Latrell, because you attended Penn State and you knew the deceased woman who accused Nate Parker of rape. Your recent essay in Ebony questions the timing of this history being raised into the limelight when Parker has never tried to hide the fact of the rape charge and acquittal. And you said you felt sorry for Parker. Can you talk more about your reaction to what's happening now?
Absolutely. So again, I did know the victim in this case. And to be clear, I've never seen any of Nate Parker's films because of that relationship. However, this is not something that is new. This is 17 years old, and I've actually been on social media with every movie saying, well, is this going to come up? Is this going to come up? And then finally, right before the release of the actual film, this finally drops. And while I believe it deserves scrutiny, I'm glad that it's out. I just wish that this would have come out years ago, and I think that it now coming after he has actually had some level of success is kind of questionable, and I feel very slightly sorry for him. That said, I do believe that we are in a new era where people's backgrounds with regard to sexual assault deserve to be scrutinized. But in terms of the film itself, I won't be seeing it, but I'm not of the mindset that if somebody wants to see it, that they shouldn't be able to. But that still is something that is evolving, to be honest.
Okay. Now, Bridget, I feel like I experienced some of the Black new wave of film with you during my time in New York. And you certainly, in your own experience, you certainly experienced the complexities and challenges of making and releasing a film, even when Black filmmakers were getting more opportunities. Yet, I know earlier this week you said you regrettably would be boycotting The Birth of a Nation. Can you tell me why and give me your reaction to the controversy and where you are now on it?
Definitely. Yeah. First, thanks for the opportunity. I think it's a really important dialogue, and I really applaud you for making sure we have it. It's regrettable for me because I have been an independent filmmaker, and I know what it takes to get an uncompromising work out in the world, and I applaud him for that. However, sadly, I just feel that he had an opportunity in this moment to really make this a teachable moment for us, and also to really be brave. It seems to me that he's still so concerned about his reputation that he is unwilling to acknowledge where we are in the culture today. We are post the Cosby scandal. We are post what we've learned about Penn State and how they ignore, how the university ignored sexual misconduct on the part of its athletes and its coaches. We're in a different moment. He could have easily, or maybe not so easily, but he could have boldly and bravely said, I now understand, as the father of five daughters, that what took place could be seen now as rape. I would never do that again today. I understand more so that a woman being drunk is not licensed to have sex with her. I mean, there are many specific difficult pieces of this story that I find problematic. But the biggest one is that he had an opportunity today to basically show accountability, and he didn't. That's extremely disappointing to me.
Okay. Now, Kenny, some of the most vociferous, I guess, critics of Nate Parker I have either read or heard have come from the Black feminist community, who are in that space of interrogating, you know, giving us the actual language to name rape culture, misogyny, misogynoir, and toxic masculinity. And for a lot of us, these are terms that we're hearing for the first time, you know, discussed in just kind of general public language. And they have been a part of the perhaps academia, the academy, and by people who are thinking about these issues a long time. So I'm wondering, as an educator, how much you think the strength really of these powerful thinkers has fueled Black social media in this case.
I have to like Bridget, congratulate you on approaching this topic. You and I have several friends of national repute who have just said, look, I will not touch this, because it's too volatile. You know, people are really worried about, you know, come out in a discussion, you know, a discussion around, you know, this this issue. But let me just, if I may, go back to something Latrell said earlier about timing. This is important, because this is kind of the crux of the conspiracy theory we're hearing about this case. And the timing of this has to do with, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
We can hear you.
The timing of this has to do with Fox Searchlight. It was them, according to the Variety article I read and the Deadline article, which were two of the first articles to address this in relationship to the new movie. According to Deadline and Variety, it was Fox Searchlight, who came to them and wanted an interview set up. Deadline, I think, had the first interview, and wanted an interview where this would be bought out. And so this was part of a PR issue. But to Latrell's point, the first thing that I've been able to find on the Internet around this issue was during the Debaters movie, where you see just a small interview where this comes up, and Parker addresses this issue. So I think it was out there before. This is a huge new movie, and so, you know, Fox Searchlight tried to get ahead of it. And so I don't subscribe to the notion that this is a, you know, sort of like what Harry Belafonte was saying, this is the timing of this was part of, you know, some broad conspiracy. But I do think, to your question, that certainly the feminists and the Black women who have brought this up have added to this dialogue, and it's an important one for all of us who are educators. And as Bridget said, it also points out really like the frustration with Nate Parker in this very teachable moment for those of us who are working with students. You know, he centered this thing, this discussion about the allegations as a part of sort of what he's going through. And initially sort of never really addressed his behavior and addressed, you know, what happened to his accuser. Mm-hmm. You know, you got no empathy, no sense of not only what I did was wrong, but the ways in which what I did affected her life bothers me. That didn't come out until it appears anyway. This empathy didn't come out until after the notification that she had committed suicide. So I think it's real important, like, not to try to relitigate the trial, but to talk about how Parker missed this moment, this opportunity to be able to both sort of educate himself and to allow this to be an educational moment. It still is for all of us around the ways in which men continue to oppress women.
Right.
So I sent some of you some what I considered late-breaking developments in the case yesterday. Four of Nate Parker's classmates, alumni of Penn State, published a letter in support in which they say, in part, we are both dismayed and disappointed at the gross and blatant misinformation campaign regarding the events that took place during that time period. The statement reads, and then it continues, we feel compelled to speak truth to this situation as the media has cherry-picked the most salacious elements while ignoring the actual record. And they go on to point out several facts. And first, they state the fact that the woman making the claim was a white college student, and the criminal trial was decided by 11 white jurors and one black woman in Center County, PA. Two, they said, despite what's been widely reported, Jean Celestine ultimately served nearly 2 years in prison while he fought to clear his name. And they're referring to a second man who was initially charged in the rape. And three witnesses were threatened by the investigators who were trying to build a case against Mr. Parker and Mr. Celestine. And as a result of those threats, some witnesses, including one of the undersigned, had to seek legal protection from the very investigators charged with finding the facts. Four, a key prosecution witness changed his statement several times after being threatened and coerced by police investigators. Five, the allegations of torture, stalking, and intimidation of the woman involved in the case are absolutely untrue. And they talk about the bail orders that barred both Mr. Parker and Mr. Celestine from approaching the young woman. And had those orders been violated, both would have been arrested before the criminal trial. I think there are two more points. Well, there are actually several more. But I wanted to get your reaction to some of the latest developments in the case. But before that, I want to play a sound clip from Mr. Cleo Manango speaking on the Roland Martin Show. He is a behavioral health expert, and he was speaking about the desire of some people to boycott the film.
People need to know the story of Nat Turner. We do not know the story of Nat Turner in this country. We know about Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, etc. We rarely hear about a black freedom fighter. And a film was made. Nate was paid. He got almost $20 million. So we're not supporting his pocket by not going to see the film. So what's important is that people know who Nat Turner was.
So that is a sentiment that is shared by, obviously, by Mr. Manango, but also other people who are watching the controversy and commenting on it. So I wanted to get your reaction, everybody on the line, Bridget, yeah, Latrell, and Kenny.
Basically, Nate Parker could have turned that around. Mm-hmm. He could have. Mm-hmm. Those of us who have misgivings about his behavior and his lack of culpability should not be shamed into believing that we must go see this film about this, you know, activist in our history. That's just unfair, right? I think. And again, it absolves him of accountability. I mean, I have a 16-year-old son. He knows already who Nat Turner was.
Right.
You understand? I mean, it doesn't require a film for him to be educated. And so while it would be wonderful to have this film out there, you're right, he's right, this gentleman, that it's lacking this particular kind of representation in popular culture. But they are not the same issue.
Right.
They're being collapsed into one when they're not. They're separate issues.
Well, some people would say that the way the controversy is being discussed is also two separate issues in a way, that not only was the incident 17 years ago, that he's never hidden his past, he's never hidden what happened, but that it's actually being relitigated now in social media in connection with a film that is not really connected to that incident. So, I mean, I know it's complex, and I just wanted to play that and also maybe get your reaction, Kenny and Latrell.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, I feel the same way. You know, trying to conflate a discussion of rape culture with, you know, some obligation of African Americans to go see a film about Nat Turner strikes me, one, as being problematic, because it presumes that Hollywood is the final arbiter of, you know, black history. And if history is any guide for us, there are going to be problems with this film and the actual history anyway. I'm not saying it's not important or, you know, the film won't be good. I'm just saying that you will still need to, after having seen this film, it will still be important to go back and, if you want to find out about Nat Turner, read the historical record, right? So you're still going to need that no matter what. And if this film didn't exist, Nat Turner would, and maybe less people would know about him, but we will still have an opportunity to learn about Nat Turner. And the way that it was framed by the guy on the Roland Martin show, just, you know, it makes it seem like, you know, you're a race traitor if you do not go and support this film, even if, you know, like Bridget, I have a 17-year-old son. If you have issues around rape culture that you think are also very important, I also have a daughter, and it struck me when Nate Parker was talking about, you know, the allegations of rape, that, you know, he sort of frames everything in the kind of, both in the kind of patriarchy and in the way we see racist frame things. Oh, I've got daughters, I have a wife, I have a mother, as if somehow that, you know, prevents them, inoculates them from having been a part of rape culture. And if you read the transcript, if you eliminate the criminal aspect of it, it still was a problem. What he did in waving in his friends to have sex with a woman who was intoxicated and who hadn't given her explicit consent for this activity is a problem, and one that we have to tell our sons that you cannot participate in this without being a part of rape culture.
Latrell?
Yes, it be like said. To, yeah, I agree.
I'd like to go back and talk about the Root article. I know I went to class with Lakeisha Wolf, same graduated at the same time. Respect her very dearly. That article,
is she one of the letter signers?
Of the letter signers.
Mm-hmm.
That was disgraceful.
Mm-hmm.
The victim is no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
And what we basically saw in that letter was slut shaming.
Yeah.
And what happened to me, so one of my connections to this case was, at the time that they were trying to find out information, a friend of John Celestian's had called me and said, could you talk to a lawyer to provide any details about Julia? At that time, I didn't have the language of slut shaming, but that's exactly what they were looking for. And I said, no, I'm not going to do this. And that entire article took a woman who, again, is no longer with us and basically tried to implicate that this was racist, that because she's a white woman, she couldn't that this was something that race was involved against two black men. They tried to imply that the racial conditions at Penn State at the time led to the conviction. No. What happened was you had a bunch of people who basically took advantage of this young woman. And now, 17 years later, you are hearing information that is basically trying to shame her. And this needs to end. This is the problem. This is why we have sexual abuse on college campuses.
Right.
Because we are going over and over to defend young men when we're not protecting young women.
Right.
I'm just,
you know, it's very interesting. I'll get to it in a second, Bridget. But I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Bridget.
I just want to quickly say I'm just really thrilled to hear these two brothers really talk and speak to this issue. It's so important to hear men speak out and make it clear that it's like unambiguous, to use Nate Parker's word, that rape is rape, and we need to really educate our sons about this situation. So I'm just applauding both of them. That's all. Sorry.
And I wanted to add, Esther, you know you're deep in rape culture when you see black people extolling the efficacy and justice of a nearly all white jury. I mean,
yeah.
To read that article in Root and to hear people say, well, there were all these white people on the jury, so it must be that this woman got the justice she deserved. You know, that's an absurdity, and that's sort of the kind of weird, you know, triangulations one has to make when you're trying to justify activity. And as Latrell say, when you're really trying to, in the way that we see a lot of rape cases in the United States happen, where there's this attack on the victim, on the accuser. And so, you know, I was disappointed by that article, but then I also thought about, you know, in the same way that, as we talked about, you know, you had a culture at Penn State that was protecting Sandusky for years when there was clear knowledge that he was raping and abusing young boys on campus.
Yeah.
So we had a caller, one of our elders here in the community, Dory Latner, called and wanted me to remind us in this conversation about the controversy over the confessions of Nat Turner, published, I think, during the 1960s. This is by William Styron, right? And how there was such a controversy over that movie because it raised the false narrative that...
Over the book.
Because it raised the false narrative, if I remember correctly, that Nat Turner was primarily motivated by wanting to rape white women.
Right.
And
Baldwin has one of the best issues attacking Styron for that. And it's interesting because Baldwin was actually living with Styron in Styron's house at the time. Styron had gave him a space to live for a while. And he just excoriated Styron for the confessions, and people can read that, but I'm not sure what that would have necessarily to do with the case. So.
Yeah. So some of the other points raised in the letter, I think there were a few more. Contrary to repeated inaccurate media reports, there is nothing to suggest that the ruling had anything to do with prior intimate contact with the young woman involved. The jury made no mention of this when they rendered their verdict. The jury's decision was based on prosecution and defense witnesses and evidence in the court record, and indicated that the young woman was both conscious and engaged during the evening in question. Misinformation suggests that a spiral into depression was triggered by the alleged incident in 1999. However, court records and testimony by medical professionals revealed a history of chronic depression that dated back to childhood and the use of antidepressant medication that preceded the event.
So after then, the conclusion has to be...
No, let me just finish the last two, and then we can go back.
Okay.
We're actually running out of time. I knew we would, but publications and the public have relied heavily on partial excerpts of one recorded phone call. There were multiple recorded transcript calls. These multiple calls in their entirety were played in court for the jury to consider and to provide proper context to the narrative. And finally, Celestine and Mr. Parker have always maintained that what happened that evening was consensual and never hid from the complexities of this, even when they were facing more than 20 years in prison.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to stop you, because this is like PR from Fox Searchlight.
Exactly.
One, it's a presumption, what, depressed women can't be raped?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, what is that about? I mean, it's just an absurd argument, and their argument ignores the fact of the eyewitness who was there and said she was not moving or responding, you know, and he said that, the person who was there and saw it. And lastly, what juries don't get up and say, we find him not guilty, because they don't say that. They just say he's not guilty. I mean, you know, the idea that the jury would have a comment on it necessarily and what made them render not guilty verdict is just kind of absurd.
But one second, I wanted to respond to what Latrell said earlier, because these are just some points, and I know further down in the letter they talk about the fact that, you know, some of them are women who have survived sexual violence, and they talk about rape and sexual violence being rampant throughout society, and they also talk about having family members who were wrongly convicted of crimes they didn't commit. So I didn't really get the sense of slut shaming that Latrell mentioned earlier. I really thought that the letter had a lot of balance in it in terms of acknowledging not only their time at Penn State and the environment there, which they said was very racist, but also their personal experiences as women and men and what they've experienced in their own families. I think we have like one more minute, so let me give everybody 30 seconds to kind of give their final thoughts on it, and I'll have to wrap up. Go ahead, start with you, Bridget. You were going to say something.
You know, it's unfortunate that really what's being unspoken there is that because she was white, there's a different standard. And we really have to move away from that. And I'm just going to end by quoting someone else. I don't know how many of you read, first of all, the transcript is chilling. And if you haven't read it, you really ought to. All of us should read that transcript. Separately, Dominique Matty wrote for OK Player an incredible piece saying why she's not going to become part of this movement, and how he's basically, as she put it, he's upholding the same legacy that he condemns. Essentially, people in his world, people don't get to decide what happens to their bodies. That's what slavery was.
Right.
And so he cannot have it both ways. That's my final point. He cannot have it both ways.
Amen.
Okay, Kenny?
Well, I mean, I would just, you know, again, go back to... I think the article on the Root is, I'm still with Latrell. I just think it's a PR move from Searchlight. I don't think it was balanced. I think it did the same thing Nate Parker did. It, you know, tried to say, oh, I understand because there are women in my life, or I understand there are victims. But then you spent two-thirds of the article attacking the woman who made the allegation. So
were they attacking her, or were they presenting a different set of facts?
No, they weren't presenting a different. They were presenting the facts that supported their position, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But don't act like there aren't other facts that are there that you decided to leave out. And lastly, I would just say, look, I support people whether or not they decide to go or not see it. But I think we have to have a further conversation about rape culture and its implications, especially for black women. You know, we keep bringing up the fact that she was white, but we need to talk about the reality for black women in this rape movement.
Okay, Latrell?
We cannot continue to protect black men at the expense of women, and particularly black women. Mm-hmm. No, she was not white, but we have gotten to a point where anytime that a black man is basically seen as doing something wrong and it involves a woman, we're told that we should support the black men. Mm-hmm. That must end, and it must end now. That's why I understand people who want to not watch this movie. That said, I also understand the nuance of wanting to see the Nat Turner movie. But the last thing I would say to that is, could we stop having movies that are simply narratives of African-Americans in slavery or African-Americans as the help? Because those are the movies that have been released in recent years that have gotten Oscar attention. They're stereotypical narratives. And if you want to boycott it for that reason as well.
Well, that will do it for us on The Ground, onthegroundshow.org. I want to thank my guests for allowing us to kind of travel through this very difficult terrain this morning. Professors Bridget M. Davis and L.D. Crittenden, and poet Kenny Carroll, my designated favorite son of D.C., and earlier in the show, Benjamin Douglas of Jewish Voice for Peace. Special thanks to Chantel James, and thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows and connect with us if you're interested in working with us on radio or digital media. You can use the website, and the email is contact@onthegroundshow.org. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On The Ground Show. I'm Esther Averam. We're going to go out with the trailer for The Birth of a Nation. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
You're a child of God. You got purpose. The law put it there, and nobody can take it away.
These books are for white folks. They're full of things your kind wouldn't understand. You're a special boy, Nathaniel. Study hard here.
Your slaves sure do know how to behave.
Well, they got Finn. One of them's a preacher.
People might pay good money to have them calm down a bit, especially by one of their own.
I lead you to Peter 2:18. Submit yourselves to your masters, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh.
I'm that. What you think you're doing, boy? I asked you a question.
You're done preaching for a little while. You learned your lesson, boy?
Oh, yes. I've learned.
To watch a strong man broken down is a terrible thing.
The Lord's spoken to me. Visions of what's to come. A rise of good against evil.
What are we gonna do?
We'll fight. But once it begins, our brothers and sisters will join. And we'll number in the hundreds, thousands even.
And we'll rise up. I like the waves. We'll rise up.
You fight.
In spite of the ache, we'll rise up.
You fight for us all.
We'll do it a thousand times again.
I pray you sing a new song.
Plays of God be on the mouths of the saints and a two-edged sword in their hand to execute vengeance on the demonic nations. Sing to him a new song.
And we'll rise up. I like the waves. We'll rise up. In spite of the ache, we'll rise up. And we'll do it a thousand times again.
Rebel!
You're waiting on something.